The first case today is United States v. R. Mr. Hotelling.
May it please this court, my name is Chris Hotelling, and I represent the United States in this appeal. The district court dismissed the indictment in this case on statute of limitations grounds after concluding that the government knew or should have known about the defendant's illegal presence in the country based on the following documents contained in the defendant's immigration file: a confidential informant tip dated September 1997, an INS preliminary investigation worksheet dated over a year later in October 1998, a violation of a supervised release report, an accompanying arrest warrant generated in December 1998, and the defendant's federal pre-sentence investigation report from 1994. All of these documents, except for the PSI, post-dated the defendant's 1996 deportation to Nigeria, and most post-dated his attempted reentry into this country through New York in May of 1998. Importantly, none of these documents establish or demonstrate that the government had any reason to believe that the defendant had returned to this country, surreptitiously or otherwise, in September 1998, as he asserts in his brief. Yet, in ruling that the indictment was not filed within the five-year statute of limitations, the district court concluded that the INS had been negligent for not continuing to investigate a person they had properly deported. Instead, the proper start date for the statute of limitations in this case should be at a point in time following the defendant's September 23, 2003 arrest by the Chicago Police Department. Following that arrest, the government discovered the defendant's physical presence, and it knew, based on fingerprint analyses and a review of immigration files, the defendant's identity as Adewumi Array and his status as a previously deported alien. In other words, both prongs of the Herrera-Ordonez test had been established following his arrest in September 2003 by the Chicago Police Department. In addition, the district court committed plain error when it held that the constructive knowledge standard applied to the physical presence prong of the two-part Herrera-Ordonez test.
Why does plain error review apply to that argument? I don't understand your concession in that regard. Because up to this point, no case has held that a constructive knowledge test applies to the physical presence component of this offense.
The reason the government conceded it was plain error is because we did not make that particular argument, obviously, before the district court.
Why would you have to anticipate the court's holding in that regard, since there isn't any support for it?
Your Honor, that's an excellent point, and Your Honor is right. There is no case law that supports the district court's position that it does apply to the physical presence prong. Nevertheless, in an abundance of caution, the government felt it appropriate to make that point. But Your Honor is exactly right. There is no legal support for the district court's conclusion that constructive knowledge applies to physical presence. Moreover, what the case law does suggest is, as Herrera-Ordonez and other circuits have held, that the constructive knowledge does apply to the identity and the status component of that two-part test.
Well, applying a constructive knowledge test to the physical presence component of this offense creates a very perverse incentive, it seems to me. If an alien surreptitiously reenters after deportation and eludes detection for the statutory limitations period, there can be no prosecution.
I agree with you 100%. I agree completely that to have constructive knowledge the constructive knowledge to apply to physical presence does have perversity, not only along the lines that Your Honor has mentioned, but as was the government indicated in its brief, this whole idea of creating this duty to investigate. You know, what does the government need to do if all that can be done is to have a, you know, for example, a confidential informant tip in the file? That does that give the government notice of his physical presence? And if it does, and some people have described it as a parade of horribles that the government outlines in its brief, but nevertheless, it is true that there are incredibly perverse consequences associated with having constructive knowledge applied to someone's physical presence. That is a grave concern that the government has with respect to that. That, in fact, going along and following along the lines that Your Honor just mentioned, it's the government's position, and that's what the government has proposed in its brief, is that there should be a bright line rule that can be made to law enforcement and immigration authorities, that this bright line rule is consistent with a rule that's been proposed by other courts. And the government describes it in its brief as the affirmative contact test. And that the affirmative contact test is what should be used by this court in terms of guiding its consideration of this issue. And what I mean by the affirmative contact test is that in order for the statute of limitations to run, in order for the government to be on notice sufficient to begin a prosecution, there needs to be affirmative contact with some sort of law enforcement. Now, it could also be a circumstance where a defendant walks into an immigration office and says, "Here I am, this is my name, this is who I am," at which point, obviously, the government knows about his physical presence. But in the case of a surreptitious entry, where every single day that individual is in the country, he is continuing to violate the law, something more needs to be required in order to trigger the statute.
Why is this a continuous violation of the law each day? I mean, you didn't make that argument, did you, really, in your brief?
In the briefs before this court, I believe that we did, and we refer to this court's decision in Rodriguez from earlier in the summer, in which unequivocally this court concluded that the found in violation is a continuing offense. There is some differences amongst the different circuits, but in terms of this court's conclusion, this offense is a continuing offense. And every single day that the defendant is in this country illegally, he continues to violate it. And that's why the government is proposing this affirmative contact test, because at that point, when a defendant and an illegal alien has contact with law enforcement, at that point in time, the government has the body. They know that this particular individual is in this country. And so once that is established and the physical body has been recovered, at that point, the government, it's relatively easy for the government to go forward into its system, check the fingerprint analysis to confirm the individual's identity, and then to consult the immigration files and confirm that this person satisfies the status component as a previously deported alien. So that's the government's position, that this affirmative contact. Now, turning briefly to the district court's analysis and its consideration of a number of documents that were in the A file, as the government argues in its brief, either individually or in the aggregate, those documents are completely insufficient to impute knowledge to the government sufficient to start the statute of limitations. I'll just finish clearly because I see my light is coming on for my rebuttal time.
One question for clarification purposes before you sit down, if you're going to reserve.
Yes.
What was the offense date that was charged in this case? Did you use the date of his federal arrest or his Chicago police arrest? Or?
We did not use the date of the Chicago arrest. We used the date that he was arrested by the marshals in June of 2005 on the underlying Eastern District of New York outstanding warrant from 1998.
For the supervised release violation?
Correct.
Okay.
That there was an outstanding warrant and that the marshals went out and executed that warrant in June of 2005.
So that was the found-in date that you alleged?
That was the found-in date. That's correct. And I see that I'd like to reserve the remaining of my time.
Fine. Thank you. Mr. Plotkin?
May it please the Court, my name is Gabe Plotkin, and I represent Adewunme Are. The district court correctly concluded that the government's September 1st, 2005 indictment charging Mr. Are with illegally reentering the United States was filed after the five-year statute of limitations had expired.
Let me ask you about this constructive knowledge thing. That generally is a theory that's applied to individuals. You can point to a person and say, you had constructive knowledge of certain event, to apply it to the government in a case like this where, you know, we know that the INS is, or Homeland Security is overwhelmed with these cases. The borders are porous, and there's people coming and going and so on and so forth. It seems to me a little odd to apply a constructive knowledge test to the government and make the government affirmatively take action at any time short of actually seizing the person and knowing their identity and verifying their illegal entry.
I think it's absolutely imperative that a constructive knowledge analysis apply in this context. And the reason is this. 18 U.S.C. 3282, the five-year statute of limitations, exists. Congress has passed that, and it applies to the case of illegal reentry. If there's no constructive knowledge analysis that attaches, then what that does is effectively write the statute of limitations out of the U.S. Code. And what it says is that the INS can ignore all signs of an alien's illegal presence in the United States. They can walk past with blinders on until they decide that they want to prosecute somebody 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later. And that not only writes it the statute of limitations out of the code, but it completely frustrates the purpose of having a statute of limitations, which is to allow a defendant to defend him or herself before facts necessary to do so have become stale. And as the Supreme Court pointed out in Toosey as well, one of the purposes of having a statute of limitations is to ensure that the law enforcement actively investigates and timely investigates criminal activity.
See, I don't know why this isn't kind of analogous to withdrawing from a conspiracy, for instance, where you have to take affirmative steps to withdraw, and that once you establish that you've taken those affirmative steps, that's when the statute of limitations would run as to your involvement in that particular conspiracy. Here, say they get this anonymous tip. What you put an affirmative obligation on the government to follow that tip up and try to find this guy wherever he is.
If I could, it's a very important point, and there are not facts in dispute here, but the way the facts are viewed, I think, couldn't be more different between the two parties. And it's not simply an anonymous tip that triggers the affirmative duty in this case. What I would point to is this sort of bundle of facts all tied to Special Agent Dibbern of the INS. On October 16th of 98, Special Agent Dibbern of the INS shows up for work at his office here in Chicago. He is assigned to the case of Adewunme Are. He's told by the INS that Mr. Are is not a U.S. citizen, that he had been previously deported. He's then told that a confidential informant working for the INS has told them that Mr. Are is back in the United States, that he is living with his wife, Vivian Adelagun, in Chicago. And he's then told investigation is warranted. And it's my position that those facts, the INS taking the affirmative step of assigning an agent to investigate Mr. Are's return based on a reliable tip that Mr. Are had returned and general location, that confluence of facts on October 16th, 1998 is what triggers the obligation of the INS at that time to investigate, because it's clear that at that moment, when Special Agent Dibbern is assigned and has the file in his hands, he has every piece of information that he needs in order to discover.
Hypothetically, what if in that week he had 10 of these reports that were dropped on his desk?
The statute of limitations is 5 years. I'm not saying that the crime expires on October 16, 1998. I'm saying that means he then has 5 years to do the investigation. It's no different than bank robbery. You go into a bank.
No, bank robbery is a discrete act that there's evidence of right away, as opposed to a surreptitious entry into the United States, which by definition no one knows about.
But in the bank, well, they know about the return. They have reason to believe the return has happened, and that's why they start the investigation. In the bank robbery, you may know that it's completed, but you don't know who committed the bank robbery. And still, law enforcement only has 5 years to go out and find the person who committed the bank robbery.
What if, in your factual situation, as you say, they're undisputed, he had actually left that address and gone to Arizona?
It's my position that, first of all, the facts show that he was at that address for
a... This is a hypothetical. What if he was not at that address any longer?
The constructive knowledge applies at a particular point in time, and I would argue that that's the time it takes place, and unless there's evidence that he has subsequently fled, for example, if it shows that he changed his name and moved away,
Suppose he moved a week before the report got on the agent's desk. In other words, he wasn't fleeing necessarily, he just moved.
Which is actually what happened subsequently, and I believe that the typical law enforcement officer investigating an alien's illegal presence would be able to find out where someone moved to. I mean, in addition to having the files there, they have access to phone book, internet, all types of law enforcement databases. This is what INS agents do. They investigate people's illegal presence. And unless he somehow hides himself or flees, which there's no evidence of, they're on notice that he's back in the United States, that the crime is complete. Special Agent Dibbern was told, go investigate his return. And the fact that they sat on their hands until Mr. Are was basically delivered to them 7 years later by the Marshals Service means that they have taken too long.
Whatever degree of knowledge could be imputed to the government by virtue of that 1997 confidential informant tip completely evaporated a couple of months after the investigation was opened, when it was clear that your client had made a failed attempt at illegal reentry and had been removed again. So whatever interpretation you're trying to put on it lasted for, 2 months, from October to December?
And that's an important point. I'm glad you asked that question, because there's no evidence in the record showing when the INS learned that Mr. R.A. had attempted to re-enter in May of 1998 prior to that. We know that the probation office determined in December of 98 that Mr. R.A. had tried to come back, and they completed their violation report. But there's no evidence as to when that violation report ever went to the INS or ever came to Agent Dibbern. For all we know, that report made it into his immigration file after Mr. R.A. was arrested in 2005. I'd also point out that the record doesn't include the substance of that report. We don't know how much information was shared and whether it was enough information, assuming the INS had it in December or even within the 5 years, that it would have caused them to terminate their investigation.
All of this seems to demonstrate the complete unworkability of a constructive knowledge test for the physical presence component of this offense, because it involves too much subjective interpretation of documents and circumstantial evidence.
I think
and
what
so
the record
is
very...
As far as a statute of limitations issue is concerned, it's not really workable.
I think it's very workable, and I think it's actually necessary, as I mentioned early, in order to give meaning to the statute of limitations.
That's not true. That's a red herring argument as far as I'm concerned, because if an actual knowledge requirement is applicable here, the statute of limitations starts running when the government has actual knowledge. So the statute of limitations has plenty of meaning.
I would point out the hypothetical that I raised in my brief of a confidential informant taking an INS agent to a house and saying, in that house is Mr. Alien, someone who you previously deported. And the INS says, yes, in fact, if he's in that house, he would be here illegally, having committed illegal reentry. You know what? Not going to go in there. Walks away, waits 12 years. All of a sudden, that guy shows up in his house, or shows up at some INS office, and they arrest him. If the statute of limitations has any meaning, it has to obligate the INS to investigate whether that person is, in fact, in that house.
Because let's go back to the language of the statute itself that applies here, which refers to this version of the offense, the found-in version of the offense, as having been committed at any time. And this statute can be violated if the alien is at any time found in. And how is your interpretation of the statute of limitations, how can it be squared with that language?
It has to be read in conjunction with 18 U.S.C. 3282. And I would direct the court, as I'm out of time, to read the case United States versus Gomez, which has this very discussion. It goes through and talks about how you have to read that language along with 3282, and that in order to give meaning to the statute of limitations, it must be, just because a crime is a continuing offense, doesn't mean it's an eternal offense that never ends. And the Second Circuit in Rivera-Ventura talks about that when all of the factors that come together at one point necessary for them to know that a person is back illegally, that's when it does end. And there has to be a constructive knowledge analysis applied in order to ensure that illegal reentry doesn't become not just a continuing offense, but an eternal offense that can last until the INS one day decides, all right, today I'm going to go arrest Mr. R.A., when it's quite possible that whatever he would need in order to defend himself has become stale or no longer available.
Thank you, Mr. Plotkin.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any additional questions for me, I believe that the government's position is outlined in its brief. I would tender the remaining balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We move.